First, a look at a potential crisis point in the Middle East. From the Arab Spring through civil war in Syria, one group of nations in the Middle East has resisted the turmoil in the region, the Persian Gulf monarchies like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, and others. But our next guest says their apparent stability is misleading.
Christopher Davidson joins us now. He's a reader in Middle East politics at Durham University, the author of After the Sheiks, The Coming Collapse of the Gulf Monarchies. Christopher, welcome to the show.
Good evening. Many thanks.
So before we get into the heart of your argument, let's talk about what's at stake. How big a deal is it for the world if Saudi Arabia and these other countries are thrown into some kind of upheaval?
Well, historically, they've played a key role in the oil-rich Gulf region, providing both stability to the international economy and, of course, since 9/11, also really performing something of a backbone role for the United States and the Western powers in their war on terror. We shouldn't forget that the majority of the 9/11 hijackers were actually from Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf monarchies. Plus, a lot of the money was laundered and wired through these states, too.
Well, and let's follow up on that some. A lot of the rulers of these countries have aligned themselves with the United States in some respects diplomatically and accepting military bases. How popular is that with the populace at large in the countries we're talking about?
Yes, this is extremely controversial. Although the West hasn't actually deployed bases in Saudi Arabia, there are nonetheless U.S. drone bases there very discreetly. And various Western forces have clearly had to move through Saudi Arabia over the years. But in Kuwait, Qatar, and Bahrain, Bahrain being the home to the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet, this is extremely delicate given the sentiments of the local populations, having large contingents of non-Arab, non-Muslim, foreign soldiers and Navy personnel situated there.
Now, that reminds me of the situation in Iran previous to the revolution. You had a very pro-U.S. Shah there and a population not crazy about that coziness with the United States. Do you, I know it's a very different situation here in some other ways, but do you see an analogy there?
I think that's a good point, and I think there are certainly many parallels between the current Gulf monarchies and the Shah of the 1960s and 1970s, where essentially we had a ruling elite operating out of touch of the reality of the Iranian street, as it were. It's the same in many of the Gulf states, where we have strong religious beliefs, believing that Islam should play a key role in government, and also Islam should actually be the foundation for democracy. But many of the Gulf states have been arresting moderate political Islamists on the grounds they are criminals and terrorists. They're unwilling to face an Arab Spring of their own, of course. We've even had the Muslim Brotherhood organizations in the Gulf monarchies being criminalized, too. This has made it very difficult, of course, for Gulf monarchs to still portray themselves as pious rulers with Islamic credentials.
And the movement seems to be toward more, not less, autocracy. And is that one of the things that has you worried about the stability of these regimes?
Yes, certainly. The book really describes a convergence of many different factors, including the rapidly changing economic conditions in these states, their international relations, too, and also the massive crackdown and clampdown that's happened over the past 2 years. Essentially, the Gulf monarchies have responded to the Arab Spring in their own backyards with two strategies, the stick and the carrot, arresting large numbers of political prisoners. Even in the United Arab Emirates, considered one of the most open of these countries, we have one of the highest political prisoner rates per capita in the world now. And alongside that, they've been ramping up public spending massively to try and keep money in people's pockets.
And then we mentioned Iran circa 1970s earlier, but also Iran, you write, today, the Shiite theocracy of Iran and the threat it presents to Saudi Arabia and other countries' role in the region. That's an issue you see as another source of instability there. Can you talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. The Iran of today is, of course, very different to the revolutionary Iran of the 1980s and even 1990s. Iran today, with a democratically elected president, Rouhani, represents in many ways an existential threat for the autocratic Gulf monarchies. These are Gulf monarchies which have historically portrayed themselves as America's best friend in the region, where America has really been obliged to turn a blind eye to their autocratic governments human rights abuses, etc., in exchange for guaranteeing the smooth access of oil exports. Now the conditions have changed greatly. We have a far more moderate presidency in Iran, of course. We also have the rapidly changing oil dynamics of the United States now having overtaken Saudi Arabia, Russia, etc., to be the world's number one oil producer. So the very pillars of this relationship are changing very quickly.
I wonder if people in Saudi Arabia and the other Kuwait and elsewhere are looking at Iran and seeing, all right, you've got this Shiite country that has really made itself the defender of the faith for the Shia world. Why isn't my country being the same thing for Sunni Islam? Is that a sense of the street, I guess, in these countries?
Yes, I think that's a very key point. Also, we shouldn't forget, in many of the Gulf monarchies, there is actually a substantial Shia population as well. They just never had any significant representation in these autocratic governments. In Bahrain, for example, where we have a Sunni ruling family, we actually have a Shia majority of the population, which are still pressing ahead with their 2.5-year-old revolution that's often described as the inconvenient revolution, given that Bahrain is ostensibly an ally with the United States. But even in Saudi Arabia, we have a huge Shia minority, ironically, in the eastern part of Saudi, where the bulk of the oil fields are.
And in the repression of Shia activism, do the leaders there say, well, you're just, you're pro-Iranian spies, in effect, as opposed to political dissidents in our own country?
Yes, for many years, but especially since the beginning of the 2011 Arab Spring Revolution, this was the knee-jerk reaction of the Sunni Gulf monarchies to blame any kind of insurgency on Iranian Shia-backed fifth columnists, foreign agents, etc. That's really starting to wear off now. We've had independent investigations and commissions in Bahrain, for example, which have described that there isn't a shred of evidence connecting Iran to these Shia revolts. Moreover, some of the Gulf monarchies don't have a substantial Shia population. That's why in the United Arab Emirates they've had to deal with their pro-democracy opposition by branding them as extremist political Islamists.
And I'm going to make a massive understatement here. The relationship between Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, other countries, and Israel has been difficult. How does that fit into this this picture of instability in the near future?
It fits in very closely. If you look at the situation at the moment, the two powers who most want the United States to fail in its peacemaking with Iran are Saudi Arabia and Israel. So in many ways, these are two powers in the region that are working together, but officially separately. However, there's a whole raft of security, intelligence, and increasingly business links connecting Israel to the six Gulf monarchies. As you appreciate, this has to be done very carefully by these monarchies, as the bulk of their population are distinctly anti-Israel, not anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic, I should add, but anti-Israeli, given the clampdowns on the various resistance and intifada in Palestine.
Just a couple years back, we saw, as I mentioned earlier, the Arab Spring. I don't know that a lot of people predicted it. It started in, I think it was Tunisia, and quickly swept through a bunch of other countries. Do you see something like that happening, a domino effect where maybe one of the smaller countries goes into mass revolt, maybe a coup or something like that, and then we see a similar spring of sorts, whatever season it is that it happens, in the other Gulf monarchies?
Yes, I think what we're waiting for in the Gulf monarchies is some kind of trigger incident to happen. We don't know exactly what that will be. It may be a particular outrage, a political prisoner is killed, a particular riot takes place, or perhaps more likely that Saudi Arabia goes through three or four kings in the space of the next few years, given that they're all well into their 80s, the various heirs in the succession process. Each time one passes away, a political vacuum will create. Similarly, in the Sultanate of Oman, we have a ruler here who's been in power since 1970. He has no sons or heirs to take over after him. So we have all kinds of opportunities waiting in the wings. I think the best way to understand why there hasn't been this Arab Spring in the Gulf yet properly is that they've been able to use their increased resources compared to the rest of the Arab world to buy off the population for the time being. But as many reports are coming out at the moment, including IMF reports, this is not a sustainable strategy, as it's massively increasing the break-even oil price these countries need in order to keep their budgets in balance.
All right, Christopher, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
That was Christopher Davidson. He's a reader in Middle East politics at Durham University, author of After the Sheiks, The Coming Collapse of the Gulf Monarchies.
Coming up next, our guest calls for deep pragmatism to bridge the gap between what he calls us and them. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.